Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 10th of March. Very nice to have you with us. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. And, yeah, should be a nice day. A beautiful day yesterday. Hopefully be a nice day today. We welcome you. We're very happy that you are with us. Let me introduce the group. A reminder that you can always join in on the conversation. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And again, we would love to hear from you. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. And welcome back, Joe. Always nice when we have you behind the microphone.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back. I thank Ray Graff for filling in yesterday.
He did terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. I had an annoying middle-of-the-day doctor appointment, so it was nice to have him take over and let me do that. So thank you. Let me also welcome our good friend Bob Griffin to the program. He is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'm glad to be here. I must admit that I have a terrible case of spring fever.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good thing to have, the weather just doesn't seem like it's hard. It is in winter anymore. So that's good.
I hope so.
Yeah. It's kind of squishy when you walk on the ground now. It's nice. Things are thawing. We're ready for that rebirth of spring. It's all good. Terry Gibson joins us as well. He is the lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI. Terry, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Just living the dream here. Happy to be here.
Well, when your dreams become nightmares, welcome to the roundtable. And Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist extraordinaire. Good morning, Rosemary. So nice to hear your voice.
Good morning. I also have spring fever, Bob. I'm planning a May Day party. You all are invited, although my sister co-planner says I have to limit my invitees to 100. You guys are definitely welcome. We're going to dance on the Maypole and drink heavily. So, way to welcome spring in the Northeast.
I just have to quickly check. What day is it? I'm hoping May Day falls on a...
No, it's a Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Perfect.
All right. I was hoping we had a show to do right after it.
Oh, no. You can't dance the Maypole and then do a show. No.
All right.
You can, but only once.
That's true. Good point, Bob. Good point. Always thinking. All right, everybody. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Bob, don't you have an interesting speech coming up that you could tell us about?
Oh, I did not know Bob had an interesting speech coming up. Perhaps
yeah,
you can tell us
university.
About it.
Am I incorrect?
No, I have a couple, actually. I'm going to I think you're referring to the talk I'm going to give about January 6th and the mirror
yes.
to our soul.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Where and when?
It is
it sounds real
Monday.
Interesting,
yeah. It's on Zoom, so I don't know the where piece, because I guess that's where is everywhere.
Yeah, right. Wherever you want it to be.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I'm actually excited about it, because I've been doing a little bit of work looking at about how Americans view themselves, and then I juxtapose what we saw on January 6th, and there's just this huge gap between how we perceive ourselves versus what happened. So, I mean, it really is. I do really view the sixth as a mirror into our soul. And, yeah. And to give you sort of a preview, I found this great quote by Michael Caine. He said something along the lines of about Superman and Batman. The former is how America views itself. We view ourselves as Superman, and the darker, brooding character of Batman is how the rest of the world views America. So, yeah, thank you for raising
wow.
that. I'm looking
cool.
forward to it.
Excellent.
Oh, no. I definitely want to hear it. It sounds fascinating. We've gotten previews of it here at the show, but here you're going to be expounding it. You won't have me and Alan interrupting you.
Yeah, you could.
Just log in.
Whoa.
All right, everybody. Well, and Bob, do we get a date on that, or don't you? I'll find it if you don't have it in front of you.
It is, I believe it's Monday, because I'm really stressing out about it. Yes.
All right.
It is Monday.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you. Thank you, Rosemary, for bringing that to our attention. And Bob, good luck. Thank you for doing that for the community. Okay, so let's start in, I thought with a day's rest, we would come in and maybe the situation in New York State would calm down a little bit. But the governor has a new accusation against him of inappropriate touching. An unidentified staff member said the incident occurred when she was working at the executive mansion where the governor lives. Now, this is interesting because we do not know the name of the woman. We also have very few details of what has come out. This was a report, I believe, yes, originally that came out of the Times Union, which reported the account. We do not know the exact nature of the allegations. And also the governor, speaking in a conference call with reporters on Tuesday, about an hour after the newspaper posted its story, said he was unaware of the new allegations, but reiterated previous assertions that he never touched anybody inappropriately. I never made any inappropriate advances, he said, adding, no one ever told me at the time I made them feel uncomfortable. So Beth Garvey, who is acting counsel to the governor, said in a statement, all allegations that we learn of directly or indirectly are going promptly to the investigators appointed by the attorney general. So they have indeed that is now starting. The matter is forwarded to the state attorney general, Letitia James, whose office is overseeing an investigation into Cuomo's actions with several other women. According to the Times Union in their report, Ms. James' office had no comment on the new allegations. So this is, as the governor comes under increased calls to resign, and the latest is Richard Gottfried, who announced, the dean, if you will, of the legislature, who says that he believes that it is time for the governor to resign. Let us begin there, Alan, and how significant, if it is significant, that Dick Gottfried would do that.
Well, I've known Dick Gottfried for a long, 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 long time, you know, since he was the youngest member of the legislature. And now I believe he's either the oldest or the longest serving. Hey, you know, Dick Gottfried is a man who has always stood for justice, law and order, but equitably met it out. I'm confused by this. You know, I am with Ms. People Stokes, number two in the assembly, who says let this investigation go forward. She's not saying he's innocent. She's saying let it go forward. Let there be due process. I am a due process person. If anything ever happened to me, I would want due process, as would everybody who is listening here. Based on accusations, I think that's not enough. I think we have to know what happened, and that's, I don't know what else to tell you. It's confusing to me. His numbers, by the way, I read one story, Joe, you're great at looking this stuff up, but I saw one story that said his approval rating was down to 38%. Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but if that's the case, you know, this guy's got to be suffering right now, and we're going to see whether or not this turns out to be as formidable as many people are making it out to be. But I don't agree with Dick Gottfried.
Rosemary.
Yeah, same as Alan. I want women to be taken seriously when they bring these charges. I want women sticking together, as seems to be the case here. One has spoken out, and so others have gotten the courage to come forward. All of that is important. That said, due process is due process, and he has the right to a response before he has to give up a career. And I don't think he's going to get away with anything from that. When you look at who Letitia James has appointed to conduct this investigation, it's no easy ride ahead for him. I can't see him getting away with anything. He's been in office for three terms. If we could stand it that long, if even the women involved could stand it that long, we can wait a few more weeks for there to be a fair hearing.
Bob Griffin.
I think, unfortunately, I'm not going to add a lot because I'm in complete agreement. I am also a big supporter of due process. I mean, it's the basis of who we are as a country. I will add this though. I was a little bit disturbed by sort of the reaction of, well, I never heard anything. I never noticed, because it sort of was a wake up call to me as someone in a leadership position that you do become blind to how you're perceived by the people around you. And regardless of gender, I think for anybody who supervises, you've got to take a look in the mirror and say, am I doing something that is being taken this way by folks that work with me and for me? I'll toss this on the table too. And I'm not a fan of term limits, because I believe term limits occur at the ballot box. At the same time, I do think that that it's healthy to have changes in administration. It brings in new people, it brings in new blood, and I'm generally a huge supporter of the governor, but sometimes it's time to go.
Pardon me. I think I disagree. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of term limits. Pardon me. Most political scientists feel the same way. The elections are what determine how long you stay. Nevertheless, the system is so loaded. It is so in favor of incumbents who can use all of the various powers for money, raising money and everything else, that one can only think that when there's a system-wide breakdown and incumbents, we call it the IPP, the Incumbent Protection Plan, Bob, is so formidable that maybe term limits are a good thing. Let me say, New York City now has term limits, except for Michael Bloomberg. It has, as you know, he got a special break. And along with him, when his formidable power, they went back on the term limit, but now they're not. And I think it's working quite well, and there's a real turnover in the number of people, and all the predictions of doom and gloom, which were that the staff would take over and they would have and the new people would have no power. Now the new people come in and they have real power, and they make sure they have real power. So I don't think I agree with you on term limits right now, the way things are working.
Terry Gibson.
So I'm a big fan of term limits. I sponsored several pieces of legislation when I was in the Senate supporting term limits. And I think this is a classic case to point to why we desperately need them, at least for the executive branch in New York State. This is what happens when an executive is allowed to stay in power over and over again in a state that is predominantly carried by one party. He's sitting on a war chest of over $16 million right now. That's an enormous amount of money to have at this particular point in time for any politician, and certainly for a governor. It gives him a lot of power. You can only accumulate that kind of money in a situation where you're not really held accountable through elections or through term limits. I do agree with Bob in that I have been continually disturbed by the way the governor has been messaging his responses to the press, and I think yesterday's message, I found continually just troubling that somehow he gets to decide what's appropriate, not appropriate, and that somehow it's up to everyone who he offends to tell him that they're offended. And this is just not the reality of how these things work. And either he's getting bad advice on the way he messages this, or he's just ignoring the advice completely.
I can't believe it's such a good point, Terry, because I can't believe that anybody's giving him advice to say what he's saying, right? Go ahead, Rosemary.
I actually gave him points for meeting with the press. I mean, this is not like Trump, who holds away when he's got bad news to contend with and knows he's going to get the questions, he answered it. And I mean, that is at the heart of the issue. He does not believe he did anything inappropriate. And those rules are changing. And it is up to women to say, no, stop it. That's not right. It is up to us.
So the idea of, but to make the, to Terry's point, and the governor has been, and I I'm going to use the word parsing because that's what it seems to me that it is, and perhaps that's not fair, I don't know, but to say, yes, I did touch women, but it was not inappropriate. Well, okay, but who makes that call? And if these women are coming forward, they are saying they felt it to be inappropriate, right?
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, it's it's clearly...
Right, and they did. Women do have to set the limits because men think a whole lot is appropriate that we don't. And we've changed the rules and we're making it clear now that you have to change too. So that is the heart of the problem to me, is that he did not think touching a woman on her bare back that he didn't know was okay. And in a different time, it might have been. It would have been for a powerful man to do that. No more. And it was the women telling him, standing up and saying, stop it, that makes the difference. Not that he suddenly knew it, that he was supposed to figure this out from the new empowerment of women. You know what I mean? And I feel like I'm arguing against the feminist point of view, and I don't want to.
No, I think sorry. No, go ahead. Go ahead, Bob.
I just want to be careful about that this doesn't become one of those trick questions like, have you stopped beating your dog? And if you say yes, then people say, well, you were beating your dog beforehand. If you say no, people say you're still beating the dog. So that's where I'm back to sort of Alan's initial point that let this process run out. You know, it's a fair process. There are people who I really respect who are running this process. Let it work its way through. But you know, it does become sort of, no matter what he says, he's gonna catch it.
So one of the things that I want to talk about when we come back is because I think all good points being made here. I am interested in just discussing what Andrea Stewart-Cousins said when she originally came out and said it was time for the governor to go, that the inability to govern while all of this is happening, and I'm curious as to what you think about that. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will discuss that and many more things. We have your letters to include as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin all making up the panel this morning. We're going to go over to news from the BBC, and then we'll be back and continue our program after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 10th of March. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. So as we continue our conversation about the latest allegation against the governor of New York State and the call by Dick Gottfried, adding to the chorus of people asking for the governor to resign. Meanwhile, I want to go back to Sunday's announcement from Andrea Stewart-Cousins, who said, quote, every day there's another account that is drawing away from the business of government. We have allegations about sexual harassment, a toxic work environment, the loss of credibility surrounding the COVID-19 nursing home data, and questions about the construction of a major infrastructure project. New York is still in the midst of this pandemic and is still facing the societal, health, and economic impacts of it. We need to govern without daily distraction. For the good of the state, Governor Cuomo must resign. Alan, when you read those words, it sounds very, it makes sense on the surface. But when you look at it, I mean, I don't know, again, back to this idea of due process, but I understand both points.
The key word here in her statement that I think is the tip-off is allegations. These are allegations. Look, he's in a very tough game. Much of what has happened to Andrew Cuomo is his own fault. You know, the arrogance, the tough guy image, the way he handled people left him with very little reserve when it came to people who would support him in this time of real need for him. Nevertheless, he was an elected governor. He's right about that. And allegations, that's the word, don't do it for me anyway. I don't think he should resign. And let me tell you, he'll go in and he'll have to work out a budget. He may be weaker in doing it, and maybe not, because he knows what he's doing. So am I an Andrew fan? No, I'm not. But I do truly believe that allegations do not rise to action. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. And if somebody doesn't like it, they can join the lumpen proletariat. Otherwise, no, lump it or leave it.
I have two other concerns about this whole thing as we rush to judgment against Governor Cuomo. One is that the governor has the right to pardon people who are accused of crimes in New York State, especially when they're cut free from federal obligations to uphold the law. And I'm talking about Trump. And a new governor in there is possibly more sympathetic to pardoning Trump and the Trump family. That makes me nervous. And second, I'm not sure that our lieutenant governor, who has not been exactly a hotspot in state politics, will do any better at forwarding our government over the next months and years than Andrew and Trouble would be. So those are two concerns, kind of crabby, but they're there. I don't think we're that bad off with having him stay in office while this is adjudicated fairly.
Terry Gibson. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say one other thing, and that is that, as I mentioned, I think yesterday, there's something, it's written in an invisible ink in the New York State Constitution, which is that you have to come from the five boroughs of New York City if you want to be a Democrat and win the governorship. So I do think that it would lead to a certain amount of electoral chaos as we move on if in fact, Cuomo does remove himself.
So just to extrapolate on that, so if Kathy Hochul from Buffalo was to become the governor, then when it came time for her to actually run, that would be the issue, right?
And we know that from Andrew, because remember Patterson, and he was there, but if it's a weak candidate, and I think Patterson was from the five boroughs, but if it's a weak candidate, then it could damage the Democratic Party. I think I'd love to hear what Terry said about that.
Yes, Terry.
Well, first of all, I would be very comfortable having a Governor Hochul. I just want to be clear on that. I think she has an enormous amount of experience in local government, state government, and I think she would be a very capable governor. So that doesn't concern me, and I would actually look forward to it. And we need to get a woman in office, in that office, for change. So I think it would be good for the Democratic Party. Could she win re-election? I don't know about that, because the point about New York City is well taken. But we certainly have many other qualified Democrats that can also serve as excellent governors. So I don't think that there's a threat to the Democratic Party structure in New York State unless Andrew Cuomo continues to press his authority and insist on remaining the king of the party. That's where I think the real damage could come in, and we might be headed in that direction if either he doesn't step down or he decides to run for re-election. So that's where my concerns are.
Bob Griffin.
In everywhere, but particularly New York, politics is a full contact sport. And there is the feeling that that there's an opportunity here to tear down a powerful figure. And God knows, as a people, we love the drama, particularly given everything else that's gone on in our lives lately. I want to go back to the sort of basic question of, it's impacting his ability to lead. I don't see it. If anybody is near the university at Albany, if you drive by and you see how the state is handling COVID, you'd see that repeated. You can go to Utica, you can go to Potsdam, you can go down to the city. I actually think that he is able to continue to govern. So I'm less worried about that situation. I had another thought and it's gone, Joe.
That's all right.
Sorry, senior moment.
That's all right. We have like another hour. So if you think of it, just let me know.
we'll
come back. Go ahead, Alan.
Joe, another part of this that just should be brought up that is really factoring into who's coming out and calling for his resignation and who is not. A lot of this is tied into the budget process that he has an enormous amount of control over. I mean, the New York State governor, regardless of who's in that position, has an enormous amount of authority over how that budget is put together. And you have to make a calculated decision about whether you want to upset the governor that's going to have the possibility of delivering and deciding that your district gets a certain amount of money for various projects or not. And you're primarily seeing legislators who are in relatively safe uncontested seats coming out and calling for his resignation. You're not seeing too many marginal members that really have tough races ahead doing that.
All right, let's go to the letters here. In our, we have about 4 or 5 minutes before we have to go over to a break, so let's get to the letters. Bess writes, it's a well-known fact, at least in the Capital District, that Cuomo is a jerk. He's not a sexual predator. He's aggressive and likes to throw power around. That's the toxic work environment that he runs. Let's see. Amy says, I think it's absurd to think that women will be able to step up and confront a superior who is harassing them without a system that protects them. I was once harassed by my human resources manager at a newspaper where I was working. I had nowhere to turn. This was a man who was supposed to represent my concerns. There was no union to help me out, so I toughed it out. Then we got this from Linda, who said, did any Republican accuse George Bush of sexual harassment when he gave Angela Merkel a shoulder massage? Did any Democrat accuse Biden of sexual harassment when he would smell a woman's hair? Regarding the nursing home scandal, how did the other 49 states count their deaths? That from Linda. Jason says term limits are a terrible. Well,
I'm sorry, Joe.
Yes.
Joe, before you go on, though, I mean, I don't want to see my leaders do that. I mean, I found both of those situations to be ridiculously creepy. So I don't want to forgive what the governor may have done just because other people have done bad things in the past. You know, we could add Trump to that. But I think that's a really slippery slope that we don't want to go down. Just because it's been done in the past, it's okay for him to do it now.
Well, I was going to say that we just have to stop touching people in general. So then comes this letter from Zuli, who writes, what we really have here is a single horny guy who, like the rest of us, doesn't know how to proposition someone for romance. So we do it at work or at the supermarket, and it comes out poorly and awkwardly. Also, it's not about a woman being touched. It's not a woman thing. No one should be touched inappropriately, whatever their genitals or their pronouns. Finally, what is inappropriate?
Okay,
hold it. One more line, and then we'll let the floodgates go. finally, what is inappropriate? If Brad Pitt touches you, it might be okay. If Cuomo touches you, not so much. That's a poor standard. Go, Rosemary.
I am not going to criticize that. That may be my favorite letter from a listener of all time. Please send me a copy.
Okay,
fabulous.
I will.
Well said.
All right. Yeah,
I think the Brad Pitt point is extremely well taken.
Exactly right.
Well, I don't know. If Brad Pitt touches me, there might be consequences. I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
He wouldn't, Barry. You know you are. He wouldn't.
Yeah.
I hope my wife's not listening, but sign me up. I mean, he's.
I'm about to say something. I'm about to say something really petty. Having met Brad Pitt, I will say that if he was going to touch me, he would need a stepladder. Okay.
He can borrow mine.
Okay. Let's see. Another letter here from. Amy, I think it's absurd to think that women will be able to step. Did we do that one? I think we did do that one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I didn't respond to it, and I think I should because I'm the one who said I think it's up to women to set the terms, and I stand by that. And that setting the terms means we increasingly are, and as we ought to be, saying this is what's right and this is what's wrong. And if you disobey us, this is what will happen to you. I believe that is setting up the system that the letter writer was talking about. I do see that as a woman's job because we left it up for men for a long time to protect us and to take care of us and to make sure these things didn't happen. And look where that got us. More than time to take it in our own hands.
Rosemary, I'm going to ask you a question which may get me into a certain amount of trouble, but I want to ask it anyway. You know, a lot of men on dates, in movie theaters, other places, have taken the liberty of that first kiss, which is sort of de rigueur. I mean, it's part of people building sexual relationships. So how do men know? I mean, you know, that's the question. How does a man know whether or not to do what has been traditionally done, you know, or a woman even to kiss somebody?
I mean, I don't think I think there's a difference between, I'm calling it sexual, but it's even like pre-sexual touching and getting to know each other, dating, and the kind of harassment that we're talking about. First of all, it's a boy you went to the movies with. So you're a very naive girl if you're not expecting, you know, an arm around the shoulder or a tentative kiss, and mm-hmm. you do deal with it. That's different than meeting the governor at a wedding and saying, thanks for honoring my friends this way and getting touched. That's completely different. So it's wrong. I think Libby would tell you how wrong it is to compare those two situations.
Rob, let's see. Just go through.
Joe, before you go on, though, I just remember a letter that we got towards the end of the Trump administration where somebody was lambasting us about what are you going to talk about when Trump is in office? And boy, we find stuff to talk about all the time. I just want to note that. Can I ask a different question?
Yes.
If I understand, so norms change, right? And expectations change. What I struggle with is going back and looking at past behavior with that new lens, and that's something I do struggle with is, you know, so how do we do that? And this is really tricky because it gets us into the question of how we think about our history and how we think about race. It's not just sex. I mean, you know, Terry, talk about religion and we'll hit the big three today. But that is one of those things that I do worry about, that the lenses we use, it's hard to make an apples to apples comparison sometimes.
Again,
I think this is a role for women. I have been in a position where I have talked to bosses saying, listen, you cannot talk to interns that way. It is not the 1950s. You cannot do that. And I didn't go to them attacking them and bringing in HR. It was a matter of education. These were people who, you know, have daughters and wives themselves, and they didn't mean anything by it, and you know they don't mean anything by it, but you can get in trouble for that now. My son is a teacher in an elementary school. He knows the rules are different now. He's very careful, and that is because women are saying, look, we're setting boundaries now. We're not waiting for you to take care of us. So a whole lot of this is on women, and that's not sexist. That's empowerment. This is what empowerment means, I think.
There's also a difference, I think, in the scenario that someone brought up earlier about taking someone out to a movie on a date versus using your authority as an employer as leverage to behave this way. And I think that's really what we have in the case of the governor, someone who has used their extreme authority in a way to really leverage his ability to get away with these things and not be questioned by it. And I don't know about this idea of expecting that everyone should raise a red flag every time that they feel intimidated. I think that sounds good in theory, but whether you're a man or a woman, there are certain circumstances you may find yourself in where the ability to do that just feels very difficult and uncomfortable. And I just don't know if it's that cut and dried.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters, we have other topics, and we have a wonderful panel. So, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Robert Griffin are here. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's the 10th of March, and we welcome you. Let's see. We have several letters. I want to get to those, and we do have a break here in just a few minutes. I know we just took one, but we were late for that one, so we'll actually make the next one, on time. Let's see. We go to Rob. I've long thought that how we view Las Vegas is how other countries view us. Debauchery and excess, low or no moral compass. Well, that's interesting. Thea says, I agree 100% that an investigation into allegations of inappropriate behavior by the governor must be the first step in any prosecution. In the same way, should not an investigation have preceded the impeachment of the past president? Do I detect a double standard?
That is such a great letter. My wife, Roselle, had, the former president's you know, utterances about grabbing women you know where out on the porch. Now, it doesn't mean that anybody gets excused for somebody else's behavior, but we sure didn't do what we should have done with that guy. And by the way, I don't know how you prosecute somebody. It's before there's any prosecution. So for what he's alleged to have done, but you know, who knows? You start prosecuting people for kissing, you're going to have to build a lot of prisons.
Rosemary?
I have said before that I felt sympathy to Republicans and constitutional lawyers who said Trump was brought up on charges before they had been fully investigated. And I think there's merit to that. I wish we had a taste for actually investigating charges against powerful people. We do not in this country, and it is a weakness.
But he said it, right, Rosemary? He did say grabbing women by the you-know-what. You know,
he did, but he wasn't prosecuted for that, Alan. It was for 24 women who have brought charges. Yeah,
you are so right.
He got and deserved the criticism for that ridiculous performance on Access Hollywood. But this is more serious than that. His liberty was never at stake. His reputation, he has no reputation. So I don't know. Yeah, we owe due process. I think Al Franken is actually, frankly, a better example of what happens when this is done prematurely than the president.
Yep. Yes.
All right. Let's go back. Irene says Cuomo has a right to due process. I think the woman making the accusations would want the process to play out for their own credibility. The Democrats should be supporting the process for all involved. Then we go to Jen. Go ahead.
Joe, can I just jump in with this one question? We talk about justice and we talk about punishment, but where does redemption sit in this? You know, we've kind of, as a panel, poo-pooed the governor's response to these allegations. But what is good enough? I mean, if somebody comes forward and says, boy, I didn't realize I was doing that. I'm sorry. I'm going to change my ways. Is that good enough? Or do we have to cut his head off and put it on a spike in front of the state building?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Which is different than redemption. That's just hearing it out, right? I mean, that's just taking time.
No. But Bob's point is what happens when somebody says, okay, you know, I hurt people's feelings. I did the wrong thing. I know I did the wrong thing. I'm not going to do it again. Is that enough? I mean, at that point, have we learned something and moved on?
Yeah. Thank you, Alan. You said it much better than I did.
Not really.
I think it depends on the scale of the accusation that you were talking about. I mean, if it's one accusation versus six versus exactly what the facts are, I mean, I think it's relative to the situation. I don't think you can just say that this is what any particular politician should do in this type of situation and be forgiven. And it is a political process that's playing out, and any political process is unique and has all types of variables that factor in. It's not a process playing out in a court of law, which would be very different.
All right. We have letters. Let me get to them here. Jason says, term limits are terrible because it just hands all the power over to career staffers and lobbyists who are not elected. Fixed gerrymandering and campaign finance in elections, that's the problem, not long-term officials.
We should just point out that the President of the United States is term limited. So that is an example of the chief executive of our country being term limited. And it's reasonable to at least consider that there could be some benefits to having the chief executive of a state be term limited.
And isn't there a piece of legislation on the floor right now which would do away with gerrymandering, basically, and assign that power to, you know, people who are more fair than what we've been looking at? You know, in New York State right now, we're about to see a gerrymander. We're about to see a gerrymander, which will be a Democratic gerrymander. So many Democrats object to it when it's done by the Republicans, But I guarantee you that any Republican congressperson right now in New York State is taking a very careful look at what's going to happen to them when the Democrats get their hands on the redistricting process.
Yep.
Jen says, ew, I don't want Brad Pitt touching me. I don't want my grandfather smelling my hair. I don't want my boss talking with me about dating or sex. I don't want my professor to stand so close to me. Keep your hands, nose, thoughts, and body to yourself. If you're interested in someone, ask them to dinner or for coffee. If that goes well, move on from there. There goes, that's Jen's thought on the whole thing. Barbara says, good grief, there's only one person on your panel who understands that sexual harassment in the context of the governor is about taking advantage of one's power and authority to pursue your personal sexual agenda. Then Lily says, it is crucial to distinguish between a boss being sexually inappropriate with women in the workplace and conduct on a date. If Brad Pitt, a 57-year-old man, treated a 25-year-old who is in his employ the way that Cuomo did, it would be equally unacceptable. Sarah says, regarding Alan's question, how does anybody know if it's okay to kiss someone? Alan, you just have to ask. Sean says, what was the lens when lynching was accepted and now isn't? So somehow it was okay in the past. To say sexual harassment in the past was somehow not wrong is sexist.
By the way, I agree with that. Yeah. One should add.
Yeah, it's an excellent point.
I can't believe the
past. My rule is that if you have to ask if it's okay to kiss me, it isn't. You should know.
Wait a second.
I'm
not sure. I need Rosemary to come back on that. You mean that nobody can kiss you ever?
No.
No. Lots of people kiss me, but they're welcome to kiss me. The ones who are not, I let that be known.
Boy, that's going to be some party.
I don't know.
I'm going to need a maypole as a weapon, for God's sakes.
You may not.
Chris says, if you're going to prosecute people for kissing, you're going to have to build a lot of prisons. Alan continues to show he has no understanding of what sexual harassment is. It's not dating. It's not flirting. It's not kissing. It's always an abuse of power. That from Chris.
Oh, maybe somebody could help me with that one. I'm not sure I understand what the point of the letter is.
The point being that it doesn't have to do with the act of being in a movie theater. It would have to be the abuse of the power, abusing the power of the relationship.
Okay, and how about all of those people, and I'm not making an argument here. I'm just asking a question. How about all of those people who have married people of great wealth and great prestige and great this and that, and with huge age differences? You want to take all those marriages back and you want to say they were wrong to do it? You want to pass your moral judgment?
But you wouldn't be there. The difference being that if you're their employee.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think there's any boss
there's
in America?
There's a difference between gold bricking and sexual harassment.
What do you mean?
Is it young women marrying rich old men and Anna Nicole Smith kind of thing? Yeah, that's kind of gross, but it's different from what we're talking about here, which is powerful, usually men, using their position to take sexual advantage over a woman. And that's different than a date. That's different than any of the other situations we're talking about. And it gets confused with those others, which is how I think men have gotten away with a lot of their behavior that's now openly unacceptable. That's how they've gotten away with it in the past, saying, oh, I just couldn't resist. She was so lovely. I thought she would return the favor. Blah.
All right. I just want to – well, okay. I there's one thing I would like to say that we keep getting letters about us laughing at the situation, like we're laughing at sexual harassment. We are not laughing at sexual harassment. We're laughing at each other. We're laughing at different things. We're taking the subject very seriously. And I don't know. I'm just taking offense to the letter. We've gotten a couple letters of people saying that we're laughing at it. And I think it's far from that. Perhaps panelists, maybe you disagree with me, but I think we're trying to make, we're trying to do a radio show about a serious situation. We are not laughing about the subject at hand at all.
Not only that, let's talk a little bit about this radio show. One of the things that we try to do is not to to argue in a hateful manner, but, you know, it's not supposed to be a one-sided radio show. It's supposed to be, well, have you ever thought about this? Have you ever thought about that? That's what makes it the number one radio show in our area by far, ladies and gentlemen, by far. It is because people say, well, it'll be an interesting show today. They're going to talk about Andrew Cuomo and whether or not he escaped the traces.
Well, let us go to a break. Ray is waiting very patiently.
And he is a patient fellow.
He is a very patient fellow.
Not.
Just saw his hand, his head in his hands. I felt bad. Okay. It's only, we're 2.5 minutes late. So we'll throw it over to Ray. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartak, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin. We welcome you and your thoughts to the program. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's move on to other topics. We have a lot of other things to discuss this morning, and I would like to get to as many as possible. So, we go on this Wednesday morning to the challenges of the stimulus. With congressional approval imminent, Biden prepares to send checks, but big stimulus challenges still loom. This from the Washington Post. Congress is set to give the final green light to a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package Wednesday, setting in motion another gargantuan political lift, a Washington-wide effort to administer one of the largest economic relief packages in U.S. history. Over the coming weeks, the Biden administration must send another round of one-time checks to millions of families, rethink vast portions of the U.S. tax code, and dole out much-needed sums to help cash-strapped Americans, seeking to swiftly blunt an economic crisis that has left millions without jobs and falling further behind financially. Biden and his aides have promised that a large number of Americans could receive their $1,400 stimulus payments before the end of March. Some of the other ambitious elements of the soon-to-be law, including new child tax support, aid to local governments, and money to help families pay rent. They could take much longer to disperse. The sheer volume of the new programs threatens to swamp federal agencies, including the IRS, leaving some lawmakers fearful about early delays. Alan, didn't we have, I mean, these have been the issues that have been all of these stimulus packages.
And I have discussed this as early as this morning in my 740-something commentary. The fact that these federal agencies, most especially the IRS, are really going to find themselves, below water here. They're going to be, it is a very tough thing. And Biden's success will be measured by whether this thing can be done right. If it can't, the Republicans will be given a lot of arrows for their quiver, and they will use them. And you will expect to see stories about people who shouldn't have gotten the money, who did get the money, or who got it and didn't spend it wisely. That's what the Republicans, who are on the wrong side of this, of course, because the American people are for this program, are going to be claiming. And they're going to do it because they're afraid of Donald Trump.
Rosemary.
Yeah, I think this is a really important issue. It is a massive administrative undertaking to administer this program. And there's also tons of money from the previous last year's stimulus package that has yet to be distributed and gotten to where it needs to get. We're just beginning now, as is the want with these giant programs, to see how massive an undertaking it is. Insurance will change. Welfare is likely to change. Loan programs, insurance, everything. And we're talking about an administration that's not even fully in place yet. So I think there's a huge risk to it. And I hope the one thing that Biden has learned from the Trump administration is to at least be transparent. There were all kinds of abuses in how the small business loan program worked in the first stimulus under Mnuchin. It went to friends of Trump and to big corporations. Companies clearly not meant to get that money, and we only found out about it through investigative reporting. So the administrators this time need to be really open and and transparent about what's happening and about mistakes and what they're doing to correct them, because that will happen.
Bob Griffin.
Oh, boy, I got a few comments on this. I think you can either have speed or you can have efficiency, but you can't have both. And I want everybody to think about their own jobs and imagine your boss comes to you and says, you now have to take on this enormous new task, which is in itself would be a full-time equivalent. And you still have to do everything else that you were doing. Because that's the situation right now. If you start to think about what we've layered on here, a couple points that I do want to remind everybody is that we've gutted the federal workforce. So when you look at the IRS, they're staffed to a minimum level to take care of the annual taxes. So this is a new responsibility. In addition, DC is still under COVID, and a lot of folks are working at home. So you've got that added pressure. And we're in tax season. There's a confluence of a lot of challenges here. I would argue that and in support of the Trump administration's efforts, I think speed was more important. I think that I realize that some people are going to get money that they shouldn't have and that needs to be investigated. But at the same time, I think pushing as quickly as we can to get money into people's hands to keep them solvent, to keep the pipeline going is real critical.
Terry Gibson.
Yeah, I do worry about there being a replay of what we saw as an example of when President Obama rolled out Obamacare and how that really got off to a slow start. There were huge problems with the website and signing up, and Republicans just jumped all over that and used it as a way to criticize it. And I think they're looking at this as another opportunity to do the same thing. At the same time, it still just points to show how divided our country has become, and that not a single Republican is really willing to side with anything that appears to be a Democratic idea. And there's a lot of good ideas in here that are going to help Republicans. There's a lot of money flowing to state governments, to education, to infrastructure, to all types of things that are needed. And everybody's going to come out ahead on this. And it's just disturbing to see that they just can't get Republicans to even consider helping them.
Anybody else? Rosemary? Alan?
No. No.
All right. Fair enough. Let's see. We'll go to this now. I'm talking about the subject of immigration. Immigration arrests have fallen sharply under this president, according to ICE data. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is what that stands for. And the president's orders to rein in ICE led to a sharp drop in arrests by the agency last month, even though a federal judge in Texas has blocked the new administration's 100-day pause on deportation. The number of immigrants taken into custody by ICE officers fell more than 60% in February compared with the last 3 months of the Trump administration, according to data reviewed by the Washington Post. Deportations fell by nearly the same amount, according to those statistics from ICE. The change indicates the extent to which the Biden administration has been able to move forward with its plan to reshape U.S. immigration enforcement, despite a U.S. District Court preliminary injunction halting its deportation freeze. The Biden administration has issued temporary guidelines to ICE officers, narrowing their enforcement priorities to focus on national security threats, recent border crossers, and criminals with aggravated felony convictions who pose a threat to public safety. Alan.
It's a tough one. I mean, we know that Biden ran being very critical of the Trump approach to immigration and to deportation and to people getting some kind of a break. And now he is faced with coming up with a program that will meet those objections that he had. But it's tough because you just can't open the border and let everybody who wants to come in. And he knows it. And he will be held responsible for whatever decision making he comes up with. I think this is one of Biden's toughest problems.
Bob Griffin.
Oh yeah, Alan, I think you're absolutely correct. I think immigration is going to continue to be a third rail issue for both parties. I'm going to take a slightly different position on this story, though, Joe. You know, to me, it actually stinks of dirty politics. I realize that Biden has put in a new policy, but I also realize that Biden's transition is horrifyingly slow, and his folks are not in place. So the leadership for Biden administration aren't even proposed to the Senate, let alone confirmed. And we're dealing with two unions that have been enormously supportive of the Trump immigration position, especially the hardline position. So you're thinking, okay, what does it got to do with stinky politics? My gut feeling is that there are ICE agents out there right now that are purposely slowing things down. That there are efforts to sabotage the administration's attempts at immigration reform, and it really concerns me. And they can't move fast enough to get new leadership into both ICE and Customs and Border Protection CBP. I was speaking with folks in D.C. yesterday, and one of the things that they told me is that in CBP, which is the country's largest law enforcement agency, there is one Biden appointee that is in place, and it's the chief of staff. And there's no other structure there right now. So, you know, when you read this, understand that there are games being played by the unions, and there are games being played by partisan politicians.
What would you do right now? If you were you didn't have your people in place, you know, the American people are watching you, you were critical in the campaign, what would you do?
A couple of things that I would put more muscle into transition team and moving appointments. I would also take a page out of the Trump playbook and find people within the bureaucracy that you knew would follow your administrative positions, and even if it's that ridiculous title of senior federal official acting in the capacity of, which we saw many times with Trump, that's what needs to be done. But when I was looking at the list of temporary leadership in DHS, and it's Trump appointee after Trump appointee after Trump appointee that's still in place.
Rosemary Armeo.
Yeah, I think that's really good points that Bob is bringing up. I my first reaction was I don't see a problem with ICE being slowed down and fewer deportations. There were way too many under Trump, and that's a good thing. The bigger problem to me is that people sensing that the reception is going to be better under a Biden administration are coming over the border in greater numbers. That is a problem for Biden before he has his team and the new laws that he is proposing in place. And he rightly, I think, put his priority on coronavirus and the stimulus package. But now that that's over, he needs to pivot very quickly. I hope things are underway to get moving on that. I think JP said it yesterday, and he's right. It will be not the stimulus and not COVID, but immigration that will decide the elections in 2 years and then in 4 years. So there's nothing more important than this. And we are very divided as a country about what we want to do.
We sure are. Terry Gibson.
Yeah, I have to agree with everything I'm hearing. I think this is a top tier priority for the Biden administration. And I think they realize that this is something that Republicans are watching very closely, and it's a very easy attack point for them. And they're going to just continue to hammer him on it. And I'm already seeing in, you know, the press briefings, his press secretary is often struggling to really answer questions about immigration in a way that really is coherent. I mean, because they're still struggling to sort of get the messaging right. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with the fact that they just don't have the people in place. So it's a very delicate issue. But it is clearly a kinder, gentler administration we have. And that is being reflected in all the decisions that they make.
And Joe, I mean, there is a crisis at the border. But I also note, if you think about how bad things are here right now, if you start to think about COVID and you start to think about the economic crisis, it's worse in other parts of the world, which always puts pressure on people who are trying to flee to America, because we continue to be the beacon of hope around the world. You also have the other issue of it's springtime, so you're starting to see some of the traditional patterns where the farm laborers are also starting to spin up, because we're going into that season. So there's an awful lot coming here. But the folks that I talk to within the federal government are admitting that there is just a huge issue at the border right now, and we're going to have to pump some real resources there.
Alan, you talked about how important this will be for the president, and certainly over the next several years as we go into midterms and in 4 years for re-election. But how patient do you think people will be for resolution, if there is such a thing on this issue?
I don't know. You know, it's an interesting question. I look at so many people who talk to me about what's going on with the Biden administration. And frankly, I'm not hearing much about immigration. Now, I don't live in Texas, you know, and I'm not on the border. I haven't heard a word about the wall from anyone. So clearly, Trump thought he knew what he was talking about by saying, you know, close the doors, don't let them in. He thought he was appealing to that mean-spirited part of the American people. You know, so I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that while it is a very important issue, it may not be the most salient political issue of all.
Let's get to a couple letters on this subject.
Well, can I just add one thing?
Sure.
I mean, whether it's salient or not doesn't make it an issue. Abortion is not the most important issue facing American yet. It seems to affect a lot of a lot of our elections and our voting. So that's hard to measure. But Bob, is that really true that we have a crisis on the border? Is it really any different this spring than it was? Certainly, I get it, stuff is up from Trump, but that was artificially pressed down by his cruel policies. Is it really any different than it was in the Obama years? I'm not seeing any evidence of that. It's not a crisis. It's a situation that we have not dealt with and that we must deal with. But a crisis? There's no caravans of people storming America. That whole crisis baloney is Trump imagery that he is still, you notice, he's come out and this is the first thing he's attacked Biden on is on immigration, because it's his issue. But I don't think the messaging that you talked about, Jen Psaki has to get her act together on this. She cannot let them get away with it and set the agenda, which I think Trump still is doing. I don't think it's real, though.
Bob,
so I'll respectfully disagree. If you look at the number of unaccompanied minors, if you look at the sheer volume of people who are seeking to enter the country, it has far outstripped the resources. And when you have that situation, I consider that to be a crisis.
Yeah, but
absolutely it has. But Trump stripped all the resources, and he did make it. He separated minors from adults that were caring for them. So isn't that just a reaction to like things returning to normal? It's an adjustment that's being made.
I think it's not just an adjustment, but I think you're seeing the pent up pressure. So yes, it's bad on a normal day. I think it's even worse right now. And when you put on top of that the fact that it needs more resources, that the administration still doesn't have its leadership in place, there's a confluence of a lot of bad things here. I think you all made a valid point about what becomes important in people's minds and how they perceive public policy. And this is one of those issues that is incredibly, incredibly divisive.
Let's see, we have just 1 minute, and I have time to read a couple of the letters on this. And then when we come back, I'll read more. Ricky says Biden should stress that his administration has stopped separating children from their families and remind us how many children were orphaned by the Trump administration. Otherwise, he should keep quiet on it and keep undocumented immigrants from sneaking across the border. That from Ricky. We go to Roy, who says, bottom line, Biden is allowing illegal immigration at the southern border while in the middle of a pandemic when the USA can barely take care of its own. There is not enough COVID vaccine to go around already, and hospitals are strapped already. Anyone want that one for 15 seconds?
My bet is that that's what Trump was counting on, that kind of an attitude. They poll. They find that this is one of the things that's on people's minds. I don't think it's nearly as important as we've indicated here, but my 15 seconds is up. I have a lot more to say.
Well, we have another break, and we'll give you plenty of time to say it. We have more letters as well. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have one segment left here. We do have a lot of letters. Alan, did you want to continue?
No. As you probably know, by now I've forgotten what I was going to say.
Well, maybe this will, we have a lot of letters on this, so we'll continue to discuss it. Here we go. We go to Sophie, who writes, I just wanted to say that the situation that is happening on the border is a crisis because of the prison camps that are there now, and this includes the ones that Trump put in and that Biden just put in his first month. Children are being taken away from their parents and dying in these facilities. This is a crisis. Rosemary, did you want to respond to that?
Children are dying in facilities separated from their parents. I don't understand that. I don't think that's happened. I think the ACLU and the Biden administration is working to end that. There are temporary facilities now because of the huge increase in unaccompanied minors. They're not being separated from family. So I think that's, Bob, you can correct me, but I think that is misleading.
Yeah, it's an important distinction, but the bottom line is that there's still a huge number of unaccompanied children who are seeking to enter the country, and their care is becomes our responsibility. So yeah, I understand the distinction, but it's in my mind it's still a crisis.
Sue writes, if we don't get a handle on climate issues, the immigration situation will get so much worse. President Biden needs to next move aggressively on climate.
John. Amen. Joe, more I have thought about this, I do think that it is the single largest crisis that faces humankind, hands down. Every element of the world as we know it is in jeopardy.
Amen.
Well, there's the problem for the Biden administration. I mean, who's going to argue, oh, no, immigration is the more important. No, climate change is more important. They are all important, and they are all reaching crisis proportions. That is exactly the trouble he's facing. So maybe it gets back to what we talked about earlier, that he needs a full team in place because he alone, and definitely not working with the Congress that he has, can handle this. He needs teams of bureaucrats and experts and everybody.
Bill writes, addressing the immigration issue as primarily a matter of enforcement and DHS responsibility is short-sighted. America may be a beacon of hope to those fleeing the poverty and dangers existing in their own countries, but the U.S. needs to take a more active role in eliminating those dangers rather than supporting oppressive regimes in our southern hemisphere. A concerted effort is needed by the State Department, DHS, and the Commerce Department, to name a few. Simply arresting undocumented immigrants is just treating a symptom of the greater problem. For too long, the U.S. has allowed and supported corrupt governments to thrive.
I think that's an excellent letter, Joe. And I go back to something that John Kelly said to me when he was Secretary of DHS, that he was really clear that he felt that Homeland Security actually, if you wait until it gets to the border, it's too late. That in order to have Homeland Security, you really have to think about the socioeconomic conditions and what's going on in other parts of the world. So State Department and USAID and all of these programs that have been cut were all designed to make it so that people wouldn't want to leave their own homes.
Alan, was there something you wanted to add to that?
No.
Okay. John's.
He is so well spoken.
John says the best thing for Guatemalan refugees is a safe and prosperous Guatemala, etc. Biden should take the U.S. Army south of the border and fight the drug cartels who are forcing these people to come here. Bill says, yes, 80 million people voted against Trump, but remember 70-plus million voted for him. I wasn't one of them. I believe a good number of the people who supported Trump did so because they believe that our borders should be more secure, and I think they are right about that. I don't care what country immigrants are from. I just think the numbers should be limited, and they should come legally. Many are economic refugees, not true asylum seekers. Terry, anything on that?
I generally agree with Bob's perspective on this, and I think that we should be representing an immigration policy that continues to be open to those who are in need of a place that is safe and secure to raise their families. And if we can find a way to get them in a way that doesn't burden the rest of our economy, we should do it. And I think that's what the Biden administration is always trying to try to figure out how to do.
I have a couple of letters on the subject that we were talking about right before the break, which was the overall stimulus package. Carol writes, on so many grounds, the GOP portrays itself as the conservative guardian of the public purse, and wrongly so. Has anyone mentioned that all those GOP-mandated tax cuts for the uber-wealthy ever taken the elites to task for not putting those tax breaks back into the economy instead of funneling the funds to the stock markets? Remember what happened just last year after all those funds went to the markets? The market had a steep drop when the black swan of COVID hit. How would this country have done not only if Trump had treated COVID seriously, but had funded infrastructure?
Rosemary?
Yeah, that's an excellent letter and a really good point. We keep talking about this massive $1.9 trillion. I think the problem is in communication and in the name. It's not really just relief. It really is a restructuring and an assault on barriers to economic progress, and that's massive. And we are rightly looking at everything that can go wrong and worrying about it. We did not do that with the tax cut, which in many ways is exactly the same thing. And it was $1.5 trillion. It also was all the arguments against the Biden bill could have been made against the tax cut, and yet somehow we're not. It helped people who didn't really need it. It threw everything out of balance. Isn't that also true of that bill? I begin to think when I keep reading this stuff that we need a new way to pass legislation. We're finding out after the bills are passed what the implications are. Isn't there something messed up about that?
Yes. Yeah, good point.
Well, in regard to the letter, there is always if Schmiff. You know what I mean? If there hadn't been if Trump had been more careful about COVID, you know what? If he had done the right thing, he'd probably be the president of the United States right now. But he's not. So, you know, there's all that we can always say, if this had happened, then this would have been different. But it is what it is.
Linda writes and says, who's responsible for the economic shambles? Why isn't Donald Trump being held accountable for his extreme incompetence? Alan said the Republicans are afraid of Trump retribution and Biden better be successful. Why is Trump not being held accountable? He was totally unsuccessful, both for the handling of the virus and the consequential economic mess. Well, you could say he was held accountable, which is why he's not president anymore.
By the election. Yeah. Right. But we know that. We know that he is... he got a lot of votes from the post-Civil War, what I've always described as the post-Civil War group in the United States, who really haven't gotten over racial prejudice or Jim Crow or the rest of it. They are there, and we better just admit it. And the people who are the most important in this country are the people in the middle, because they're the ones who gave those extra 8 million votes to Biden. Whether they're there when this is over, if the Democrats make mistakes, if they alienate that 8 million people, they lose, and whoever, Trump or whoever, will be the president again. You got to be very careful here. I know that's not popular with our audience, but you better think about it.
We have a few minutes left, and I know you discussed some aspects of this yesterday, as we did the day before, which is about what is the situation with Buckingham Palace. The news yesterday, of course, that broke was after 48 hours, the palace finally broke their silence on Meghan and Harry and the interview, saying the whole family is saddened. It took a long time, I think, two days, but you know.
Yeah, but the last time they took forever before the Queen actually, with Diana,
yes,
did something. So they've learned something about getting out there faster.
Assertions that a member of the royal family had raised concerns about skin color of the couple's son, Archie, and that a desperate Meghan had contemplated suicide dominated national discussion in Britain, where the interview with Oprah Winfrey was broadcast on Monday evening. And in a brief statement, Buckingham Palace said that the issues raised by the couple, particularly that of race, were concerning. It didn't deny the allegations and said that while some recollections may vary, they are taken very seriously and will be addressed by the family privately. Rosemary, what do you think?
Well, as you know, I don't generally like frivolous news about royals, about the Kardashians, yes, but not about the royal family. But this is different. I said that yesterday. I think this is this interview has opened up in Great Britain and elsewhere in the former colonized world a really important discussion about entitlement and race and prejudice and how we move to another level. So I think it is hugely important. I think the palace's statement is pretty vapid. What else could they have said? It's sad for the Windsors. Anybody who watches The Crown know that this is a pattern that repeated from the Wallace Simpson to then Princess Diana and now to Meghan Markle. And that's a family tragedy. But because of the royalty, of course, it translates to a wider audience. And so I await with eagerness what happens next. Also, Piers Morgan is an ass.
Oh, such an ass. Such an ass. And wow. he's gone. And, you know, we got rid of him finally at, you know, when we got rid of him at CNN, it was a happy day here in this country. And then he went to go co-host Good Morning Britain on ITV and then came under attack for saying he didn't believe a word of the interview. He resigned the network after one of his co-hosts basically went after him. On set and said, you know, you're being ridiculous, and then he stormed off and will not be coming back.
Joe, you're an expert on this stuff. You are.
Hardly, but okay.
No, you are, and I respect you.
On the stuff of TV and radio.
TV and radio.
Okay. Oh.
When he got up and he walked out of there, right?
Yeah.
That was stupid, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, he mumbled something to, and we don't know exactly what he said, but you know what, I guess it would be if, you know, one of us on this panel got up and left.
I'm leaving.
Right. But I think that's one thing. But the fact that I think what's different in this case was that he dominated the news cycle. He became the story over what was happening to Meghan and Harry and the issues because he has such hatred. And I don't really think there's any other word for it for Meghan Markle. And so the network and the ITV was obviously trying to, you know, call him on that. And so then he got up and left. I don't know, Rosemary, what do you think? I agree with you with your assessment that he's an ass. But beyond that,
Rosemary, I have not realized that. He is a man scorned. He dated Meghan Markle briefly and then apparently went on a date with him. They had drinks. It was really great. And then she went in a taxi to another party and that's where she met Harry and it was all over with Pierce. It's so pathetic.
All right.
So,
we have to.
Yeah, I don't like him.
We have to go, unfortunately, but I would love to talk about this more.
Thanks. Okay, let's put it on the agenda. Wait for me to come back.
Please. Alan, Rosemary, Terry, Bob, thank you all. We'll be right back.